I'm Steve Kresge, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to Congressman Kevin Yoder's 3rd District seat, the challengers just keep coming. In part 3 of our series with Democrats hoping to unseat the Republican congressman, we meet 2 first-time campaigners, attorney Brent Welder and former banking executive Sylvia Williams. We'll see where they come down on the issues facing Kansas and the nation. After that, we'll spend some time with Bill Littlefield. The host of Only a Game is retiring this summer after 25 years behind the mic. We'll reminisce on his career and get his take on a few contemporary sports stories. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The race for the Democratic nomination for the 3rd District of Kansas is picking up steam. 6 candidates are vying for the opportunity to take on Republican incumbent Kevin Yoder this fall. Today we conclude our series of conversations with the Democratic contenders. Joining me here in the studio are Brent Welder, who's a labor lawyer and long active in Democratic politics. Brent, nice to have you.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Sylvia Williams retired last year after a career as a banking executive. Sylvia, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Brent, the furor over the president's immigration policies that involve separating kids from their families is the hot topic in national politics these days. The president says this is a way to crack down on immigration by sending a message that is of that this is a matter of consequence as illegal border crossers could face. What do you make of it?
Well, if we need to crack down on immigration, this is absolutely not the way to do it. President Trump is taking unprecedented actions to rip children away from their families. There's been accounts of breastfeeding children being taken from their parents, and these kids are being put in essentially what's essentially a prison for up to 22 hours a day in overcrowded facilities. It's immoral. It's disgusting. You know, I'm the father of a 5-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old daughter. If anyone ever tried to take my kids away from me, you know, you wouldn't want to see the wrath that would come from that.
Sylvia Williams, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's not American and it's completely immoral. I was encouraged slightly this morning when I saw the Methodist Church step forward and send a letter to Attorney General Sessions. And they're actually doing they're calling him to the carpet on his actions. I think the next step that we need to visit is to really look at where Kevin Yoder stands on this issue.
He's come out against.
Somewhat. He is actually the chair currently of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security. So he would actually have subpoena power to go in to these facilities and review them and get some answers for the American public.
And just for the record, he wrote the other day, that's why I'm demanding that Attorney General Sessions halt the practice of family separation at the border immediately as Congress works toward legislative solutions.
Yes, but I would like to see him do more immediately. I would like for him to go down to the border himself, use his subpoena power, maybe bring some clergy. He's also a member of the Methodist Church himself, and review exactly how these children are being treated, especially the toddlers that are in these so-called jails.
Brent Welder, what do you make of the reaction from the Republican congressional delegation in Kansas to what's been going on here?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, Kevin Yoder was recently named as chairman of the Homeland Security Subcommittee for the Appropriations Committee. Kevin Yoder, this is a pattern of him not taking leadership. If anything, if he takes any leadership whatsoever, which he rarely does, it's leading from behind. It's only after the public is so outraged that it forces him to do something. You know, another example of that is the issue of guns. He never showed any leadership on this issue whatsoever. He's been, a tool of the corporate gun lobby, of the NRA, and it took public outrage, and then he started making tiny little steps to try to, trick the voters into thinking that he's actually doing something about this. So whether it's guns, whether it's immigration, he's leading from behind. He's not doing what he needs to do, and it's too little, too late.
And that's why you're running against him.
Exactly.
Sylvia, do you share that view?
Yes.
Okay. And that's why you're running, too.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and one of the big reasons I'm running against him, too, is that he is one of the most corrupt members of Congress. And what I mean by
corrupt.
That— Yes, and what I mean by that is he has taken, for instance, more money from the payday loan sharks than any member of Congress, and that's the House or the U.S. Senate. And what does he give them in return? Every single time he's slipping corporate loopholes, tax cuts, all kinds of horrible policies into federal legislation, and then the money continues to roll in. I've actually fought my entire life against to root corruption out of government, against big money in politics. I was one that actually wrote the amendment for the Democratic Party to say that as a party, we need to ban corporate money from politics altogether. And from the beginning of my campaign, I have made a pledge to not take a penny of corporate PAC money.
Are you saying the congressman is guilty of pay for play? He's sponsoring legislation in exchange for campaign contributions, just pure and simple?
100% pure and simple. I mean, he has, you know, it's been well documented in the press that he has taken language from Citigroup lobbyists and put it directly into legislation that has hurt our economy. This needs to end. At the last quarter of last year, of all the money he raised $500,000. Less than 500 of it was from small dollar donations, and a majority of it was from PACs, and most of those were corporate PACs.
Less than $500 of the $500,000?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, to kind of put that in to kind of show the contrast in that, my campaign has received over 11,000 donations from people across the district, people across Kansas, frankly, in all 50 states of the United States. And our average donation is less than $30.
You're saying the number of donors he received in his campaign, 500, not the number of dollars.
The number of dollars he received from small dollar donations, which is $200 or less. I know it's unbelievable, Steve. In a 3-month period, he received a total of less than $500 from small dollar donations, which is defined by the FEC as donations that are $200 or less, while he just received hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of PAC money and corporate PAC money. He's selling out. He's not just selling out. He's selling us out, the voters, and that's why I'm running against him.
Sylvia Williams, why do you want to go to Congress? Why do you want to be a member of Congress?
Well, first, I want to respond to what Brent said. I don't even think we have to go nearly as far as where Brent's going on Kevin Yoder. I think where the real frustration for me is as a voter in this district is just his inconsistency. When he does reach out to the community, just on this border situation, he'll say one thing, but then his votes, when you finally follow him up, are very inconsistent. So his actions don't line up with what he's saying out in the community. Whether you follow him on education, immigration, or even his health care votes. I know he showed great empathy to so many people with pre-existing conditions or with people on that need access to health care if you have children up to the age of 26. But then he voted to repeal the ACA, I can't tell you how many times, so with very little empathy. So I think we need someone that will actually follow through on their words and has a consistent message.
So tell us why you want to go to Congress, Sylvia.
To change this path that we're on.
Mm-hmm.
When I reach out to people, whether they're on the Republican side or Democratic side, I keep hearing like we need another Dennis Moore. And what Dennis Moore was to me was an honest broker. You know, you might not agree with every vote he ever took, but he would sit down, you know, explain why he took the vote he took. And he wouldn't tell you one thing and then go back to Washington and just for, you know, loyalty to the party, go against completely everybody in this district's best interest. So I think we need an honest broker and someone that will stand up for the Kansas 3rd and make sure that they vote for what the people need back here.
Brent Welder, what would you bring to the table? What do you offer the voters of the 3rd District that would help them as you navigate Washington?
So I grew up, Steve, with humble beginnings and, you know, worked my way up, tried to keep my nose clean and work hard through college to law school. I actually was so proud to have worked with Barack Obama on his first presidential campaign to try to achieve so much change in this country. I then became a labor lawyer representing union workers and going after the giant corporations every single day that are actually now paying off Kevin Yoder. And I've been working my entire life to try to change this corrupt system we have in Washington. And now I'm ready to take that fight to Washington on behalf of the people that need a voice there. They're not getting that voice, and I'm going to take their voice to Washington.
You know, if Kevin Yoder, I've asked other candidates this question, Sylvia, if he's so out of touch, why has he been elected to the U.S. House not once, but 4 times?
I think he's a good politician. And I think that taken a while for people.
Voters don't get that?
It just seems like they possibly forget it when they he does a good job of like showing up and starting to moderate right before election cycles.
So the other thing, voters.
Yes. Well, I think to some degree. Mm-hmm. But you know, the things that Kansas really need also, like myself as a woman who spent 30 years in the private sector, we need to send someone to Washington also that will address women in the workplace. As someone who spent 30 years in a male-dominated field, which I was very fortunate, I was very successful, but I can't tell you how many times I was up against equal pay and didn't really have an avenue to go to get that fixed a lot of times on my own. I got married later in life. I had a child at 45. I'm now 52 with a 7-year-old, believe it or not. But I'll pray for you tonight.
Yeah.
I just had a C-section, just gotten home from the hospital. My husband said, your paycheck didn't hit. So I called Human Resources, had just gotten home from surgery, and they said, well, you don't expect to get paid while you're on maternity leave. It's enough that we have to hold your position open.
Oh, you're kidding.
So yeah. I just think things like that, when you look at where women in the workplace are, Kansas women are currently only paid 77 cents on the dollar on average. And if women were paid equal in Kansas, it would actually cut the poverty rate in half. Hmm. So that right there fixes a lot of problems for families. So that's one of my big issues. As a woman, you can't fight it inside. That's why I want to go to Washington and be one of those voices to fix it from Washington. Because you put your career at risk if you try to fight it while you're in the private sector.
Brent Welder, let me get your take on this. The 3rd District keeps sending Kevin Yoder back to Washington over and over and over again. They clearly, arguably, they like him.
What Kevin Yoder has been doing is spending millions and millions and millions of corporate dollars to run TV ads to lie to the voters. The ads he runs, the image he tries to portray, have absolutely nothing to do with his voting record behind closed doors. He hasn't taken leadership on any important issues, but one thing he will do is he will always keep his hand open to those corporate lobbyists, to those corporate PACs, and take that money because then he can run the ads. What we need, and what Dennis Moore did so effectively to win this district, is a grassroots campaign that's focused on the issues. I'm a longtime grassroots organizer, as is my wife. In fact, she was the Latino Outreach Director for this congressional district when Dennis Moore was in office. And for the last year, we have had a field staff and volunteers going door to door in this district and talking about issues that no one has ever talked about running against Kevin Yoder. Things like single-payer Medicare for all, $15 minimum wage, finally getting the corrupting influence of money out of politics. And last year, I was the first candidate for federal office in Kansas to talk about real serious gun reform like the assault weapons ban.
Let's talk about that for a moment and turn to guns because this is a key issue in the race. What about this notion of an assault weapons ban, Brent Welder? Because the reality is the bulk of the gun crimes in this country are committed with handguns. So where do you come down?
There is a mass murder in this country on average every single day of the year. The thing that reminds me most every single day on this campaign trail about how important it is to fight for instance, for an assault weapon ban as well as so many other reforms, was the shooting in Newtown when a maniac was able to get an assault weapon, walk into a school, and massacre innocent little children just about the same age as my daughter. This happens over and over and over again. Last year in Las Vegas, it was one of the worst mass shootings in our country's history. And what have our leaders done? What has Congress done? What has Kevin Yoder done? They've done absolutely nothing. Kevin Yoder votes with Donald Trump every single time, but he can't vote with innocent victims, with children, with members of our community.
Sylvia, you're for an assault weapons ban, but again, how do you square that with the fact that the bulk of the gun crimes in this country are committed with handguns?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I grew up in Southeast Kansas, in Parsons, Kansas. My dad hunted every single weekend. I'm not a gun owner myself, but I grew up in that culture. And I understand that the Second Amendment, wanting reasonable gun laws, is not in conflict with the Second Amendment. He was a very responsible gun owner. He kept them locked up. As he got older, he actually just, got rid of his guns on his own. But we need universal background checks. We need to reinstate the ban on military-style assault weapons. We had that for 10 years during my lifetime. And,
But would it make much of a difference if most of the crimes
were committed with handguns? Yes, because they're so much more lethal. If you get shot with a handgun, you actually have an 80% chance, I believe, of living. If you get shot with an assault weapon, I believe it's somewhere around like 75 to 80% chance of dying. So you can't sit there and say that, you know, they're machines to kill people. I actually have members of my family that do own these, and I have not been able to get a reasonable answer from them on why they feel that they need them.
You know, Brent Welder, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with two candidates for the Democratic nomination for the 3rd District of Kansas, Brent Welder, Sylvia Williams. You know, the notion there's already two guns in circulation for every American adult, is all this talk about gun laws just folly then? Because gun laws arguably aren't going to do a whole lot when there's that many weapons out there.
Well, you know, when Kevin Yoder says, or if he is saying that, you know, for instance, an assault weapon ban wouldn't make a difference, I have a question for him. I actually went, I've been determined to be a Moms Demand Action Gun Sense candidate in this campaign. And before that even, I went to a conference with Moms Demand Action, which is one of the leading
What group is that again?
Moms Demand Action.
Moms Demand Action.
And they brought in one of the mothers of one of the young students at Newtown that was massacred. And I had a chance to talk to her, give her a hug, and talk to her about this. What I want to ask Kevin Yoder is, if it doesn't make a difference, I certainly think it makes a difference in her life. I certainly think it makes a difference in the lives of every single family member, every mother, every father, every sister, brother, and grandparent out there whose child has been the victim of gun violence. And if he thinks it doesn't make a difference, then Kevin Yoder, stand up, have a spine, call for a ban on assault weapons, and call for common sense reforms in guns.
Well, Sylvia, this is all, you know, all this rhetoric sounds good. It's tough stuff, but, you know, Republicans are in a different place, and many Democrats are too, when it comes to the Second Amendment. So what's the middle ground here? I mean, can you cite an area of potential compromise? Is there a place where Congress can go to resolve this and move forward, as opposed to just talking about it from both sides of the aisle?
I'm not willing to compromise on banning military-style assault weapons.
Or anything else when it comes to gun control?
And I think we need – I think it's been so long since we've actually put into place any sort of reasonable action. There needs to be a little bit of a catch-up period, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think wanting universal background checks, I think the majority of people that are actually member of the NRA are actually for that legislation.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you talk about age limits, I think a lot of states are – and also NRA members are open to that. As well as, I think the ban on assault weapons, I think if you look at the national polling, the majority of people are open to that. So these are all reasonable measures that do not attack people's Second Amendment rights.
Where do you come down on this, Brent? Is there a middle ground here?
What we need is leaders with a spine, right? And there are things here that there's no middle ground on, because it makes all the sense in the world. Should people on the terrorist watch list be able to have guns? No, there's no middle ground. The answer is no, the people believe it, I'm fighting for it. Should domestic abusers be allowed to have guns? The answer is no, there's no middle ground there on that issue. And we need leaders in Washington who are willing to stand up and fight and show leadership and move the dials on these issues and talk about it. I've been talking about this issue since the very beginning of my campaign, that Medicare for all, $15 minimum wage, free college education.
Okay, let's switch topics here and move on to something else here, Brent. Legalizing marijuana for recreational use. You for it or not?
You know, I think that, you know, that's certainly obviously a state issue. I think the people that I talk to around here, almost everybody thinks that marijuana should be legalized. And the reason they think that is a couple of reasons. One is they think that that the marijuana laws and the drug laws are being implemented in a racist way. If you have a, you know, 20-year-old white college student that gets caught with a joint, almost nothing happens because they can, you know, hire lawyers that take care of it for them. But if you have a 20-year-old, you know, black kid in a tough neighborhood that gets caught, they can be charged with up to a felony. They can end up getting no college tuition because of it. The other reason, and you know, I've had extensive discussions with Barry Grissom, who is the former U.S. attorney in Kansas, about this. You know, and he agrees with me from the criminal perspective. The other reason is that it's good for our economy. We need to, you know, marijuana is out there. People are smoking marijuana. Our presidents have, you know, admitted to doing drugs, right? What we need is to regulate it so it's safe. We need to be able to tax it. Look at places like Colorado. They have been able to tax marijuana sales, and they have been able to use that money so well. In fact, I just saw that they've put a couple million dollars into helping the homeless because of this.
Sylvia, where do you come down on recreational use of marijuana?
I do think that that is a state issue. I will say from a medical use, we need to get that passed in the state of Kansas. We actually have Kansas families that are hurting and having to move to other
for
states.
For medicinal use, you're saying.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And I don't understand why our state hasn't moved that direction yet. I think that's a first step before we start talking about for recreational use.
Brent, let me get a comment from you. You just are in the newspaper today for apologizing for sending out an email about the deaths of two Wyandotte County Sheriff's deputies that led to a fundraising page. Why was there an attempt to raise money off that tragedy from your campaign?
Well, first of all, there was no attempt to raise money, and nothing in that email asked for money or referenced money. And I want to be able to say what the facts are about this. From the very beginning of my campaign, obviously campaigns send out emails. Sometimes it's fundraising emails. Sometimes it's calls to action. And I've been out front on trying to stop the gun violence epidemic in this country. What happened in this particular case is, you know, my campaign is expanding. We're getting closer to Election Day. We have a brand new digital director on our campaign who, made a mistake. And what happened was this email was not a fundraising email. When people clicked on it, they went to a petition page to take action on gun violence. And then after they signed it, it mistakenly went to a neutral page, you know, that had fundraising links on it. But what I did when I did not even know that even existed. I didn't know that happened until one of my primary opponents made comments to the Kansas City Star. They called me. As soon as I found out about it, I immediately apologized. Okay. We fixed the error, and I donated the money plus some to the victims' families, and my personal family is also making a donation to the families.
Sylvia Williams, I haven't asked yet about how you feel about President Donald Trump. Just lay it out for us. Where do you think he's done well? Where has he fallen short?
I don't think he's really, in my view, obviously I'm running for office because I think we need a check on the executive branch. And I don't think that there's anything that I truly think that he's done well. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you look at, was it good that he finally went over to North Korea and talked versus the Twitter war he had going on? Yes, I guess that was somewhat, but he had created the problem to begin with by having the Twitter war. So he creates a problem and then he goes out to try to solve the problem. I do think that people in this district are tired of the chaos and hopefully they value getting a check on him in the House.
But the 3rd District came within a single point of going with Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. Hillary Clinton won the race in the 3rd District by a single point.
You know, I was born and raised in this state. Plus, I'm raising my family here. And, are there certain parts of this district that like his Tax Cut and Jobs Act? Yes, there's part of the district that it's very bad for as well, but there are parts of this district that like that particular piece of legislation. You know, I will have to say it still doesn't justify just his, you know, attack on women, attack on minorities. The families of the Kansas 3rd do not like that type of dialogue. It's not how we want to raise our children. It's not the person that we want to have our children look up to. And we need some sort of check and to make sure that the dialogue changes in Washington.
Brent Welder, on Donald Trump, what do you think?
Donald Trump is, you know, I call him our misogynist in chief. He is a bully. And you know who he picks on? He picks on the people who have no power in our society, who have the least voice. He's picking on women, ethnic and racial minorities, the elderly, now even children. He's a bully, and we need somebody to go there and stand up to him. You know, he did lose our congressional district. And you know, the reason that I think he even was as strong as he was here and certainly nationwide is that he was lying to the voters and using right-wing wedge issues to try to get the voters of so many people that voted for Barack Obama, and he was able to convince them to come to his campaign because I don't think the Democratic Party did a good enough job of outlining, you know, populist economic policies. But right now, I am beating Kevin Yoder by 7 points in this race, and I think the reason for that is a couple things. One is that Kevin Yoder is, you know, at an unprecedented negativity level in this district. I think that's because he votes with Donald Trump every single time. But also, I think it's because I'm running the type of campaign that's talking about bread and butter economic issues, raising increasing jobs, raising wages, giving health care to every single person, protecting pensions, and getting the votes of people that voted for Obama and then voted for Trump that we can bring back to the Democratic Party with these economic ideas.
Sylvia Williams, let's turn this conversation a little bit here. There are six of you Democrats in this field, and I've had all six of the candidates now here in the studio with me. You know, when it comes to the issues, correct me if I'm wrong, but there aren't miles of difference between the six candidates on the big issues facing the country right now. So how are voters to sort out the six candidates and draw a distinction between all of you? Because it's going to be asking a lot of voters to figure out where all of you come down.
I do actually think that we differ. We all support the same issues, but we have very different paths on how to get there.
Yeah.
Being someone who spent 30 years in business, like when I look at healthcare and I agree that it's a right, not a privilege, and eventually we need to get to single payer. I do understand, though, the need to address the cost of prescription drugs before we just expand like to a Medicare for all, just to set it up to fail because of all the abuse right now in the prescription drug industry.
So you see a path forward in terms of a step-by-step thing where your opponent here, Brent, is saying he wants to do the whole thing now.
More of like a short relay.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a sprint.
Okay.
And the same thing with Social Security and Medicare. I have specific ideas on how to fix that, like lifting the cap for employers on FICA, which would fund Social Security. It would actually help out the deficit because then Social Security would be funded.
This is the cap, the maximum amount that...
right now it's like $128,000 or something.
So if you earn more than that, you stop paying
The employer side only.
Yeah.
The employers just got the biggest tax cut, even way more than they asked for. So now would be the time to finally fund some of those programs, have employers step up, pay a little bit more in, and make sure that we save those important programs that our seniors need. So even though we all want to do all those things, I do think we differ on how we get there.
Brent, how would you answer that?
Steve, there are miles of difference between me and the other five candidates in this race. You came out reporting and followed me around as I was going door to door. And you know the issues that I was talking about then. You know the issues I've been talking about since the beginning of this campaign. Medicare for every single woman, man, and child in America, $15 minimum wage. And I was right out front, the first one talking about things like the assault weapons ban. This is something that people haven't seen a candidate in Kansas or federal office talk about. And it's something that that separates me from my Democratic opponents. And, you know, the reason that we can't just wait to take one little incremental step after another is because there are millions of people, children, people working hard every single day that have no health care whatsoever. And what do you say to that child that gets sick or injured? Do you say, oh, well, just wait about 20 years? No, you don't. The time is now. 2/3 of the Democrats in the House of Representatives have co-sponsored Medicare for All, and it would be so sad if we send a representative to Congress that doesn't support
Sylvia.
That.
The other thing that I didn't get to finish was I'm the candidate that can win in the general. And I say that because I have strong community ties. And when you look at the numbers, we currently have 195,000 Republicans, 139,000 Democrats, but 143,000 independents. And a large part of those 143,000 independents are the mothers within our communities throughout the Kansas 3rd District. I'm an active member in the League of Women Voters. I'm in United Methodist Women. I'm in Building Better Moms. I'm actually a Girl Scout leader.
All right.
I'm also a member of Moms Demand Action. All of those women's groups I've been active in for years are where we're going to be able to get those 30 or 40,000 votes we need to get to win.
I'll give you 20 seconds.
Yeah, let's talk about numbers. I'm beating Kevin Yoder in independent polling by 7 points right now. I've had 11,000 people either volunteer or donate to my campaign. And 60% of our district is not registered Republican. We need the people that voted for Obama and then Trump to come back, and we do it with strong economic policies.
We're going to leave it right there. Brent Welder, Sylvia Williams, two Democratic candidates for the 3rd District of Kansas. The primary is in August. The campaigning is picking up in earnest. You can tune in anytime you want. Thank you both for good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Time for a break. When we come back, Bill Littlefield of Only a Game joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, an eyewitness to the police shooting of a woman with a sword in North Kansas City gave us his account of the events. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we say farewell to Kansas City Star columnist Janae Osterholt before she heads off to Boston. We'll chat with her about her time down at 17th and Grand tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's official. Bill Littlefield, the host of Only a Game heard here on KCUR, is retiring after 25 years. The one-hour weekly program airs on more than 250 stations nationwide, reaching more than 400,000 listeners a week. The show is centered on the games we play, but what makes it memorable is it's a sports show that appeals even to those who aren't the biggest sports fans. It's stories like the one on Zippy Chippy, the horse that ran 100 times and never won a race. Now a conversation with Bill Littlefield as he prepares for new adventures. Bill, welcome and congratulations on the upcoming retirement.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Tell us the tale of Zippy Chippy and why this was such a good story for Only a Game.
Well, it started out as kind of a small story, a little item about a racehorse that had performed a number of times without managing to win. And then we started to follow it, you know, and it was Zippy Chippy has been in 27 races and has not yet won. And then it was 32 races, and then it was 60 races. And eventually we got kind of fascinated, and we started updating Zippy Chippy reports on our program. And you know, we told the story, and it was a story of a trainer who simply saw the charm of allowing his horse to keep running despite the fact that he was eating as much hay as any other horse but not winning any money. And people kind of wrote in, and if we didn't say anything about Zippy for a few weeks, they'd write in or email in and say, what's Zippy up to? Did he finally win? And so for our 20th anniversary show 5 years ago, we decided it would be fun to kind of revisit some of the stories that we'd had a lot of fun doing. And I said, well, I'm going to find out where Zippy Chippy is and actually make a house call. And Zippy was living on a farm up in Saratoga Springs, New York, near the racetrack there. And I went up, and I was very fortunate. It was a terrible day. It was muddy and cold and rainy, so there weren't any other tourists there to visit various retired racehorses. And Zippy and I had a quiet few minutes together, and I fed him.
Good tape.
And,
good tape on that, Bill.
We did. We got Zippy on tape. As a matter of fact, you know, the woman who runs the place where Zippy and the other horses are in retirement was able to get Zippy to comment, and so we do have Zippy on tape in that piece. And it's one of the more obviously longevity was a major feature of the Zippy Chippy story. It went on forever. But the other thing was that people kept writing and commenting on it and having a lot of fun with it. So you know, I'm glad we found it.
You said once that the stories picked for Only a Game had to intrigue you in one way or another. What does it take to intrigue Bill Littlefield?
There are all sorts of ways to do that. Certainly Zippy's story was interesting because I'd never heard of anybody keeping a horse on the track that long. You know, it's expensive, mm-hmm. yet this guy did it. But the stories about athletes who have overcome substantial obstacles, certainly guys who managed to get a medical degree at the same time they're playing in the National Football League, yeah. You know, anything that sort of reminds you that admirable as these athletes are for the things that they managed to do in competition, things that you and I could never dream of doing. They're also just people, and they have the same kind of challenges off the field and sometimes in life beyond their professional careers that everybody else has. And some of those stories have had real longevity. I mean, we were among the first programs, the first reporters and writers to recognize how bad CTE was and how many former NFL players
the brain concussion syndrome,
suffering from brain damage that had completely altered their lives. And so that's obviously something we stayed with for a good long time. But some of them are just kind of fun things. And a lot of times listeners would write in and say, you know, my son is on the surfing team at the University of Maine. And I would scratch my head and say, who knew the University of Maine had a surfing team? So we'd find out about it.
You want to go find out about that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, public radio is not known as this, you know, big sports network. How tough was it for you early on to sell the idea of a sports program to a skeptical public radio audience?
Well, I'd probably have to ask the marketing people that, but it wasn't tough for me because I'd been doing sports commentaries for about 8 years for WBUR and for NPR's Morning Edition, and I knew that I would hear from people, and some of them would say I was an idiot and didn't know what I was talking about, and others would say, hey, thank goodness somebody's finally talking about this. I saw this as a story, and the sort of mainstream sports press wasn't carrying it. So I knew that NPR listeners paid attention to sports, and we did a little homework, and we found out that in great numbers, they join gyms, and they compete in weekend leagues and play softball and ice hockey and soccer and everything else you can imagine. So there was an interest, and they are about as likely to follow the home team in the major sports as people who don't listen to NPR are. So, you know, it wasn't really an issue, and the program took off pretty well.
I was going to say, how gratifying is it for you that the show grew to be carried by 250 stations across the country? That strikes me as pretty special.
Yeah, it was special because they continued to employ me. And I've always appreciated that fact no matter where I've worked. So, yeah, it's been great. And it's been fine to see the audience grow, and very nice to be in partnership with so many excellent public radio stations across the country.
You know, I take it as someone who has devoted their career to sports here suggests that you were undoubtedly a star quarterback in college.
No.
No? Really?
I was in fact...
Don't shatter any illusions here, Bill.
No, I was one of the world's most active intramural athletes. I played intramural everything when I was in college, and I announced to the captains of all the intramural teams for my residential college that I was available for everything, as a result of which I once got to bowl against John Hersey, which was pretty exciting. And I played everything there was to play and had a great time.
Who's John Hersey?
Oh, John Hersey was a Belle Fredonno and Too Far to Walk, a wonderful writer.
Ah.
And not a very good bowler, happily, because I think we won when we bowled against him and his college that he was the master of. So, you know, I've always enjoyed sports. I played everything. I was good enough to get picked and not get left out. But nobody ever mistook me for a prospect. And that's actually something I'm grateful for, because I knew at an early age that I better find another way to support myself, because it wasn't going to happen as a result of pro sports.
Bill Littlefield is my guest, retiring after 25 years of hosting Only a Game Heard here on KCUR. What was the particular challenge of putting that show together each week, Bill?
Well, the initial challenge, we were a local program for a very brief time, and the initial challenge was to cover local people in a way that didn't just echo what, you know, the newspapers and the sports radio talk shows and the television news were doing. We had to find ways to, you know, get athletes to talk about things other than what was that pitch you threw that the guy hit out of the park and beat you with.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to go down when we were still a local show. I used to go down to Fenway Park, for example, before games, and I would just look around for stories that none of the other writers or broadcasters were paying any attention to. I remember one day being down in the visitors' dugout when the Twins were in to play the Red Sox, And there were these coaches suddenly got up, these older guys got up and out of the dugout with a fungo bat and a ball and went out and started hitting baseballs off the wall. And they came back. I said, what are you guys doing? And they said, well, we're playing baseball bocce. We hit the ball against the wall, and then the other guy has to try to, you know, duplicate the same shot with his fungo bat and baseball. And they were having a great time. And it was a little bit of insight into how coaches who really had nothing to do until the game started but had to be there 3 or 4 hours before it started, how they killed the time. And they kept track of who was winning and told me that Fenway Park was the best place to play baseball bocce because the wall went in so many different directions and there were so many nooks and crannies in the park.
Well, people were wondering, you know, that you're retiring after 25 years. What will happen to the show?
Oh, my assumption is what will happen to the show is it will go forward with a different host. And WBUR is in the process
of
looking for a new host and trying some people out. And it's going to be a great July for me because when they try people out, I can say, geez, I don't want to be looking over that guy's shoulder. I guess I better go to the track.
Well, let's bring in someone who's been a contributor to Only a Game since 1995 and has been doing the same here at KCUR for a few years. That's sports reporter Greg Eklund. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Greg.
We wanted to talk about current events in sports with you, Bill, and there's the saga of the Oregon State pitcher Luke Heimlich, who was a teenager pleading guilty to molesting a six-year-old relative at one point. He was not selected in the Major League Baseball draft for the second straight year this year. Greg Eklund, what do you make of that?
I think that a lot of teams, including the Kansas City Royals, are still trying to do their homework on this guy because there's no doubt that this guy has the talent to reach the big leagues, but there's so much of a background to this story. I think teams are going to be extra diligent in how they handle this very sensitive case.
Bill, will a major league team, you know, take a chance on a guy with this kind of background in this environment?
I think that's an excellent question, and I don't have any idea. one of the things that I've found over the years is that you really can't generalize too much about executives in the front offices any more than you can generalize about second basemen or left-handed. Well, you can generalize about left-handed pitchers. That's true. But who knows? I would imagine probably somebody would take a chance if this kid is as good as Greg is suggesting.
What do the two of you make of Phil Mickelson's meltdown at the U.S. Open on Saturday when he when he jogged after yet another errant putt and then shockingly swatted the moving ball, you know, back toward the hole with his putter? Bill Littlefield, what did you make of it?
Well, I think that the marvelous thing is that what would pass as nothing much anywhere else qualifies as a major scandal in golf. This, to me, says more about golf than
it does about
than almost anything else.
Yeah, it was quite a moment. Greg Eklund?
Well, I have to preface my remarks in regards to Phil Mickelson that my view is somewhat tainted because after a Ryder Cup a few years ago, instead of handling his views on Tom Watson as the team captain behind closed doors, he pretty much publicly threw Tom Watson under the bus in front of everybody. And I didn't have so much of a problem with Phil Mickelson's actions on the golf course the other day. My problem was this concoction that he drew up afterward and trying to spin it his way. I just thought that was the more hypocritical part of that whole story.
What he said after the hitting the moving ball.
Yeah, you know, I didn't mean to offend anybody. I didn't really, you know, deserve to, you know, I didn't mean to disrespect the game and all that. I mean, he took enough time after that round to think about what he was going to say, and I don't buy the whole selling point that he was presenting afterward.
Greg, the World Cup is coming to the U.S. in 2026, and Kansas City now has a shot at hosting a game or maybe even two. How do you regard our prospects, and how significant a development is this deal with FIFA and the World Cup?
This is huge. I mean, this is the world event. It's ongoing as we speak. for Kansas City to be among the cities under consideration. I think Arrowhead Stadium as a facility ranks very high. Kansas City needs to improve over the next several years some of the other aspects, and Kansas City is already on its way to doing that with the hotel rooms being expanded around the city and with the airport to be undergoing a major reconstruction
in the future.
That's
a big deal, but the U.S. isn't even in the tournament this year, and people... That's muted a lot of interest, hasn't it?
Well, of course, it does because of the U.S. not being there. But that doesn't mean 8 years down the road that that the U.S. is going to punt on its chances of getting back in. They're hoping to be back in 4 years from now when it's in Qatar.
Bill, how good a job has FIFA done, the organization that oversees this soccer? How good is a job has that group done with getting its house in order, you know, following that corruption scandal back in 2015 and most recently with a video of referees and officials accepting bribes?
I don't think you should pin it on 2015. I mean, FIFA has a long and proud history of corruption. As my friend Charlie Pierce has said numbers of times, other sports sometimes run afoul of organized crime. FIFA is organized crime, and they have been. It's unbelievable, except it's been going on so long that we've learned to believe it. It's been said of baseball, it's a great game. It must be a great game to have survived the people who run it. I think that's true 10 times over in terms of the soccer realm over which FIFA presides. It's a disgusting, greedy group of lords who believe that they are entitled to first-class everything, and they've been stealing money from the people who should have been benefiting from the playgrounds they said they were going to build all over the world for many, many years.
Finally, I guess, Greg, the Kansas City Royals are dropping like rocks this season, and now there appears to be a warehouse sale underway. Hitters are being traded away, so are pitchers. Is this what has to happen to small market teams to become competitive again? Because the Royals don't have a lot of talent left in the cupboard, do they?
They don't, and the answer, sadly, is yes.
This is just ugly.
Because teams like the Royals just have a short window to capitalize on the talent that they're able to build. The Royals did that with successive World Series appearances in 14 and 15, and now they're paying a price because they're not in the market to afford all the players that they had from those years.
We're getting a new TV contract next year, though. That should help, at least I've read it.
It should, yeah, it should. And the Royals, I'm sure, are banking on a better deal than they have currently, because that's going to help pay those salaries down the road.
Even the general manager, Dayton Moore, Bill Littlefield, came out in the paper today and said he didn't think that the team would drop this this fast, this quickly. For fans up here, if this is the way professional baseball is, boy, this is painful stuff.
Well, maybe they should take a leaf from the book of the Las Vegas Golden Knights and just, quit. Stop, close the whole operation down, and then start over real quick. And then as an expansion team, which they would technically be if they were to start over, they might win it all. Or at least get to the World Series. I mean, the Knights didn't win it all, but they made it to the Stanley Cup final.
It's almost reminiscent of what Bill Veeck did in the 1970s when he was taking, basically what were referred to as rent-a-players at that time when he was taking all the cast-offs and has-beens, and they turned into the Southside Hitmen and gave the Kansas City Royals in the late 70s a pretty good run for the division title.
And of course, Bill Veeck has a proud history of having fun in baseball, which made him something of an anomaly. If they could do anything that would remind people of Bill Veeck, I would buy myself a Kansas City Royals cap and be on their side.
Well, that's why we love Bill Littlefield of Only a Game after all these 25 years. Thanks for the great stories, Bill. We wish you all the best in retirement, and thank you for taking some time today as well.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, Steve.
Greg Eklund, always good to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we find out more about Missouri's new lieutenant governor and why state Democrats are so upset and suing over his selection. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.